Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the press call on the crime and science. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Emmerling, you may begin.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for calling into our press call today, Climate Science, Setting the Record Straight. I'm Susie Emmerling, and I'd like to first give you my contact information in case you have follow-up questions after the call. I can be reached at 202-481-8224, or my email address is semmerling with two M's at americanprogress.org. Today we have Professor Michael Mann, Dr. Gavin Schmidt, Professor Michael Oppenheimer, and Dr. Joseph Rome. I'd like to start today's call by passing the floor to Dr. Joseph Rome.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joseph Rome, a physicist who runs the blog climateprogress.org for the center. We've gathered some of the top climate scientists in the country because those who have spent decades attacking and misrepresenting the scientific understanding of climate science are redoubling their efforts based on a misrepresentation of some illegally hacked emails. As the journal Nature editorialized yesterday, nothing in the emails undermines the scientific case that global warming is real or that human activities are almost certainly the cause. As Nature noted, that case is supported by multiple robust lines of evidence, including several that are completely independent of the climate reconstructions debated in the emails. Let me add, scientists have been predicting for decades that pouring more and more heat-trapping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere would change the climate. It's happening now. As NOAA's climate monitoring chief pointed out in October, the last 10 years are the warmest 10-year period in the modern record. Even if you analyze the trend during that 10 years, the trend is actually positive, which means warming. I would add, several studies released this year show that most of the warming is going where scientists expected it to go, which is into heating the ocean, which continues to reach record levels both at the surface and down to 2 kilometers. While the warming is about as fast as scientists had predicted, ice appears to be melting around the globe faster than scientists had predicted in the Arctic, in the Greenland, and even Antarctica, where a recent study even suggests we may be seeing ice melting in East Antarctica, which is quite unexpected. And all of this is the key reason that sea level rise has accelerated in the past decade. These observations are unequivocal. The question is what will happen in the future, and that is still in our hands. On the eve of the Copenhagen conference, the latest science tells us one thing about the future with high confidence. If we stay on our current emissions path of more and more emissions, then greenhouse levels will achieve dangerously high levels. Serious impacts like ocean acidification are quite impervious to political rhetoric and can only be addressed by sharply and quickly reducing emissions. Let me introduce the three climate scientists here. Professor Michael Mann is director of Penn State's Earth Systems Science Center. He's the author of more than 120 studies in professional journals and a new book, Dire Predictions. Dr. Gavin Schmidt is a climate modeler at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. He's the author of more than 60 studies and a recent book, Climate Change, Picturing the Science. And lastly, Professor Michael Oppenheimer is director of the Program in Science, Technology, and Environmental Policy at Princeton. He has authored more than 100 articles. Dr. Mann?
Yes, well, thanks. I'd like to point out that I'm just a member of a very large community. There are thousands of scientists around the world who have been working hard for decades to understand our climate system and to provide decision makers the scientific information that they need to make informed policy. The result of the research, again, decades of research is, as Joe Rahm has already said, there's a very robust consensus that humans are warming the planet and altering Earth's climate. And this consensus is shared by virtually every professional scientific society in the U.S., the National Academy of Sciences, the National Academies of all of the G8, all of the major industrial nations. The changes in our climate are already disrupting our environment, and further increases in greenhouse gas emissions will lead to increasingly greater disruption. The world governments are at the cusp of a crucial conference to take place in Copenhagen in just days. And in advance of this meeting, two dozen climate scientists, including myself, produced a report called the Copenhagen Diagnosis. And if you Google those words, you can find the report online that summarizes the current state of our scientific understanding and goes into detail about many of the scientific points that Joe Rahm already talked about, including the fact that we now know that the major ice sheets, just in, over the past few years, we have now learned for the first time that the two major ice sheets are indeed melting, and that will likely contribute to a faster rate of sea level rise than we had previously thought would be the case. Unfortunately, despite this very strong consensus that exists, there are a handful of people and organizations that have tried to cloud the debate, and they've frankly they've not contributed to an honest scientific discourse, but have engaged in this 11th-hour smear campaign where they've stolen personal emails from scientists, mined them for single words or phrases that can be taken out of context and misrepresent what scientists are actually saying. And I think this is rather telling. The scientific evidence for the reality of the problem and the need to do something about it is overwhelming. Those advocating inaction don't have the science on their side, so they've turned to this last-minute smear campaign. And I hope to correct the record with regard to a number of the specious claims that have been made in recent days as a result of those stolen emails, and I will be happy to entertain questions about that later.
Gavin?
Hi. My name is Gavin Schmidt. I'm a climate modeler at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. And what I'm going to briefly go through is the six reasons why we think that this that climate change is currently a problem, and it's currently a problem that we're causing, and why it is going to be a problem. Those six steps are not affected by anything in these emails, and I think it behoves us to know exactly where that science comes from and where we need to be focusing when we're trying to work out what the uncertainties are and what's going to happen in the future. So the first thing that you need to know is that there is a natural greenhouse effect. That's what keeps the planet livable. Without the greenhouse effect, we'd be much, much colder, about 33 degrees Celsius colder than we are. This is something that's been known for hundreds of years. We know that carbon dioxide and the other trace gases, including methane and ozone and water vapor, all contribute to that greenhouse effect. We've been measuring that from space for a number of decades. We worked out the theory of that, 50 years ago, and we understand why those trace gases impact the greenhouse effect. We know that the carbon dioxide levels have increased by more than 30% in the industrial period. We know that methane has more than doubled. Nitrous oxide has been up 15%. Tropospheric ozone has also increased. Other compounds that didn't even exist in nature, CFCs and HFCs, are all adding to the greenhouse effect. We know that the amount that these are adding to the greenhouse effect is significant. And we're getting up to the point where the total amount of forcing from these greenhouse gases is equivalent to if the sun brightened by about 1%. Now, that's a very, very big number indeed. We know that the climate is sensitive to those kinds of changes. We can go back in past climate. We can go back to the last ice age. We can go back to the early Holocene and lots of other periods in the past, and we can work out why the climate changed and for what reasons. And that gives us this range of sensitivity of around 2.5 to 5 degrees Celsius for a doubling of CO2 that that the IPCC has talked about for many years. The best guess for that sensitivity is about 3 degrees for a doubling of CO2, and we will likely get to a doubling of CO2 under a business as usual scenario sometime in the middle of this century. When you add up what we've done and what impact that is likely to have, we end up with scenarios for climate change in the future that put our planet in a position that it hasn't been in for maybe millions of years. The Pliocene 3 million years ago was maybe 3 degrees warmer than today and was associated with sea level rises of 20 meters higher than today. Now, that's a very long-term change, but we're pushing the planet towards that kind of level of change. And that's not something that policymakers, citizens, or scientists ever want to see happen. So that's it.
Dr. Oppenheimer.
I'm Michael Oppenheimer. I'm an atmospheric scientist at Princeton University. From my point of view, the most important issue is whether anything has been added to or subtracted from the scientific picture of global warming that's emerged gradually over several decades of careful analysis by thousands of experts. And the answer is simple. From a scientific point of view, nothing has changed. It remains true that Earth has warmed more than a degree Fahrenheit over the past century, largely due to the human-made buildup of greenhouse gases. It remains true that the global average sea level has risen about 7 inches over the past century, and that's enough to erode or submerge about 60 feet of sand along the typical East Coast beach. It remains the case that both major ice sheets, as was just mentioned, are losing ice at their peripheries rapidly, making a substantial and, I would say, surprising contribution to sea level rise. And it remains true that the ocean is more acidic than it used to be due to the buildup of carbon dioxide. Finally, it remains the case that the projections of future climate change are every bit as discouraging as they were before the recent flap began. Nevertheless, it's important to recognize, and I think most of my colleagues in the scientific community do recognize, that public confidence in science and the manner in which it's conducted is and always has been crucial for assuring that governments will actually use the advice that scientists provide them. We know that our success in discovering the truth depends on our openness with each other, and I think we also understand that the transparency of science toward the public is a key to maintaining confidence in us as experts. That is why the scientific community's broad participation in IPCC and other similar institutions, and by the way, I'm proud to have been associated with IPCC for 20 years, that's why that participation by the community, that broad participation, is so important. IPCC provides a powerful example of how scientists can make themselves and their research openly available and exceedingly useful to policymakers as well as to the general public while maintaining the highest standard of quality and scientific integrity. That's all I have to say. I don't want to repeat what other people have said, and I'm happy to answer questions later.
We are ready to take questions, yes?
Yes.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Our first question comes from the line of Andrew Rifkin with New York Times.
Hey, thanks for holding the call. One question, so this is for Gavin and Mike. Do you think, given the, you guys have worked really hard to kind of keep yourselves separate from the political process and to just state clearly the science, including on your blog, is there a reason this call is being handled through the Center for American Progress, which has a very strong agenda, as opposed to, let's say, the AGU, the AAAS, or some other scientific entity?
This is Mike Mann. I can take a first stab at that. They chose to organize this. They asked us if we would participate, and we thought it was a wonderful venue for us to try to get out what the science actually has to say and to address some of the specious allegations that have been made. If AGU or any other organization had asked us to participate in a similar conference, I can only speak for myself, but I think that we all would have been happy to participate in that as well. But the Center for American Progress is the first one that came to us and asked us if we would be interested in doing this, and I personally have no problem doing this with them.
Okay, Gavin, do you have any problem with it?
No. People all over the spectrum ask me to talk to them, and I'm perfectly willing to talk to anybody and through anybody.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Jim Montevalli with CBS.
Yes. I'd like to ask the panelists whether you think that we will see either a cap-and-trade system or a carbon cap, and what the timeline of that may be. It seems unlikely that's going to come out of Copenhagen, but are we likely to see it? What would be your timeline for when some form of carbon regulation is enacted?
Let me take that. This is Michael Oppenheimer. I think that, well, we already know there isn't going to be a binding agreement out of Copenhagen because the governments have so indicated. There will instead be a political or agreement in principle. I would the major reason that Copenhagen isn't expected to reach closure is that the U.S. Congress hasn't yet acted and the president hasn't signed any legislation. There are different views on how quickly that can happen. My own personal view, although it's no better than anybody else's, is that it'll probably happen in the spring. And if that does happen, then I would expect that there would be a global binding agreement sometime within 6 months or a year thereafter. But those are just, you know, political guesses aren't worth that much.
Anyone else want to look at that?
Well, this is Joe Rome. I'm happy to say, I think that President Obama, Senator Reid, Senator Baucus, Senators Kerry, Graham, and Lieberman have made clear that we're going to see a climate bill debated in the Senate in March or April, and I think that is going to lead to a climate bill, and I think that it will be part of the two-step process that the biggest emitters stated. Copenhagen is the first step, and I expect that, you know, a domestic climate bill will ultimately lead to the finalization of a international climate deal. But that's just my estimation.
Your next question comes from the line of Stephen Struhl with National Review.
Hi, thanks for doing the call. My question was regarding some of the passages in the emails. One in which Dr. Mann wrote, we have to stop considering climate research as a legitimate peer-reviewed journal, and another in which concerned the journal Geophysical Research Letters, in which Tom Wigley wrote of getting a particular editor ousted. I was wondering if you could comment on those passages and whether these emails call into question the peer review process.
Thanks. This is Mike Mann, and I'll be happy to address that question. So it's important to understand what peer review actually is. Peer review is not a license for anybody to publish in the scientific literature an article that doesn't meet the basic standards of quality that are required for publication in the scientific literature. That is to say, an article which makes credible arguments for, provides credible evidence for the conclusions that it reaches. And in the case of climate research, what had happened here was that there was an editor who appeared to be, in essence, gaming the system to allow through papers that did not meet the basic standards of science simply because they expressed a contrarian viewpoint about climate. And there's absolutely no problem in the publication of papers that express skeptical viewpoints. Some of my papers have been cited by climate change skeptics as supporting a skeptical viewpoint. For example, the work that I've done suggesting that natural variability on long timescales may be more important than once thought. So there's nothing wrong with skeptical science being published, but skepticism works both ways. A true skeptic, which all scientists should be, is somebody who looks at both sides of a problem, who looks for weaknesses in both sides of an argument, not somebody who simply ignores the evidence on one side of the argument so that they can reach a preordained conclusion. And it was the judgment of the editor-in-chief, Hans von Storck, that the, in essence, the violations of those basic standards of quality in the peer review process had been compromised at this journal, Climate Research. That led to the resignation of the editor-in-chief, Hans von Storck, and it led to the resignation of half of the editorial board of that journal. And that's very unusual. For something like that to happen, that indicates that there really is a major problem with the journal. Even the publisher, who originally was resistant to allowing von Storck, the editor, to write an editorial commenting on how the peer-reviewed process had failed, even after von Storck quit because he was not allowed to write that editorial, the publisher said, indeed, the peer review process had failed here.
And the issue with geophysical research letters?
Well, that appeared to be a somewhat analogous situation where there were a number of papers that were published that did not meet those basic quality standards. They did not make a credible case for the conclusions that were reached. And there were a series of such papers, the frustration with the fact that, once again, the peer review process, which is supposed to filter out papers that do not make credible cases for the conclusions that they reach, had failed here. And Tom Wigley was expressing his frustration with that.
Let me add a couple of points. In the Tom Wigley case, the editor involved wasn't pressured to resign. Tom Wigley suggested going through official channels if there had been failures in peer review. That was never pursued. Nothing ever happened, and the guy did his full rotation as editor, and then just kind of rotated off when his time was done. I'd like to also stress that scientists care very much about the quality of the journals that they publish, because if a journal is perceived to have lax reviewing standards, then you're kind of tarred with the same brush. If you publish in that journal and then people think that that journal will just allow anything to go in, then your work becomes devalued. And so scientists spend a lot of time trying to make sure that the standards of the journals that they publish in are withheld, because that reflects very strongly on the quality of their work. That's why it's so hard and so desirable to get into Nature or Science, because they uphold very, very high standards of peer review. So it makes a difference that you're publishing there rather than in, you know, the journal of Upper Whoop Whoop. These things do make a difference. And so scientists are concerned about standards of peer review. Now, that's certainly not undermining peer review. It's asking for peer review to be maintained. And I think it's very important that that point be stressed.
Thank you. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Richard Harris with NTR.
Hi. Thanks for doing the call. Pardon me, Mike. First of all, I'd like to ask you how you see the investigation at Penn State playing out. What does that look like? What's involved in that? And also, I would like you to address the one of the more disturbing emails. It was the request from one of your colleagues for people to delete any emails related to AR4, which is presumably the fourth assessment of the IPCC. I think that's drawn a fair amount of attention. So, thanks.
Sure. With regard to the first question, there seems to be a fair amount of confusion out there about what Penn State is doing. There is no investigation. Penn State is simply, to my understanding, reviewing the evidence that is out there to determine if there is any reason for an investigation. And in fact, I welcome that. I have nothing to hide. I've done nothing wrong, and my work has been held to the highest quality standards. The National Academy of Sciences specifically reviewed my work and said that our basic 10-year-old conclusions still hold after multiple independent studies have tackled the same problem, and that there was absolutely no indication of anything inappropriate in the science that we've done. So I think my record stands for itself, and I welcome any scrutiny of that record. Now, as far as that email that you referred to, well, that, frankly, that I think the sending of that email demonstrated unfortunate judgment on the part of the scientist who sent it. To my knowledge, nobody acted on that request. I don't think any emails were deleted. I certainly did not delete any emails in response to that request. I felt uncomfortable in receiving that request. And again, it showed perhaps a lapse in judgment.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the line of Jen Broder with New York Times.
Anybody who wants to tackle this one, but you all seem to agree that nothing in the email traffic that we've seen recently undercuts the basic scientific argument for global warming and its human causes. Do you think, though, that it undercuts some of the political and policy justification for what's about to happen in Copenhagen or in the United States Senate, or that it will be used that way?
Let me answer that. This is Michael Oppenheimer. As far as Copenhagen is concerned, I don't think this will have any effect. I don't see it as even registering on the meter. On the other hand, in terms of what the debate in Washington may be on the climate legislation, I would expect the those opposing action to throw everything, including the kitchen sink, into the debate, and this will be one of the things that gets aired. It already has been on the floor of the Senate. So, yeah, one can expect this to come up. Do I think it'll be a significant effect on either the judgment of the lawmakers or public opinion? No, I don't. But you never know with these things.
Yeah, this is Joe Rome, Climate Progress. I think and I've said on Climate Progress many times, I think one of the surprising and unfortunate occurrences in U.S. politics in the last two or three years is that the opponents of climate action and clean energy have not only not moved their position in response to the overwhelming science, which was articulated and summarized in the 2007 IPCC report and then has clearly strengthened in the last 2 years. Not only haven't the opponents of action budged, but they have, in fact, redoubled their disinformation campaign, whether it's funded by the American Petroleum Institute or the polluters, whatever it is. I don't think there was any chance whatsoever that they were going to stop misrepresenting the science and claiming that the global warming is not a problem. So what you're hearing now is just a different variation of what they have been, the opponents of action have been saying for 2 years. So I don't expect it will move them. Anyone who can be moved by science is getting more concerned about the need for action based on the science. I think, fortunately, as we saw in the U.S. House of Representatives, and I think as we will see in the Senate, the majority of members of Congress understand how strong the science is and the urgent need for action.
Thanks. Next question, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Daniel Stone with Newsweek.
Next question, please.
Can you hear me? Oh, I think I was muted for a while there. Dan Stone here with Newsweek. One of the things that a lot of us have been trying to figure out is the correlation, really, between the U.S. domestic policy and the international accord, any international agreement in Copenhagen. Interested in some thoughts on how any of you see the two related, how each will impact each other, which can and will come first, and how that will impact the other.
Well, this is Michael Oppenheimer. I think the president made quite clear that there's only so far he can go, or that the U.S. can go in Copenhagen until there's congressional action. So that's on the table, and the president put a U.S. position, which, for instance, indicated a range of reductions while citing the same number in terms of the 2020 and 2050 targets that are in the House bill. On the other hand, the administration has also indicated that there are some things that can be done by executive power without waiting for the Congress to act. So I think over the next few months, there's going to be an interesting set of actions and positions taken that will see progress at the international level, progress in the Congress, and action on regulation at the executive level, which will all sort of interact with each other and eventually dance toward both a domestic U.S. and a global policy on dealing with climate change.
But does one happening first make it, you know, pave the road with the other to make it easier?
I think they're interact. You know, it's a little late to talk about one happening first. It's clear there isn't going to be a binding agreement at the international level until there's congressional action in the United States. On the other hand, there is also executive action happening in the U.S., for instance, this tightening of stringency of fuel economy standards. And, you know, these three things are going to march together. They're going to be tightly related, I think. I don't think one can get all that far out ahead of the other. On the other hand, you have to realize that even if the Congress passes legislation, even if there's an international agreement, it may be some time before any international agreement is actually ratified by the Senate. So another thing that's going to be going on is the U.S. is going to be developing policy and moving along in parallel with whatever other countries do, both inside and outside the context of the treaty. So it's a complex world that we're moving into. There are a lot of different levels of control of climate change that are already happening and more that are going to happen in the future. And I think people have to get used to the fact that this is a multi-layered situation where progress has to be made on many fronts at once.
If I could, this is Joe Rome, if I could add, I think that, you know, the big emitters said that Copenhagen would be the first step in a two-step process. Obama has said he will come to the table with targets, obviously ones that Congress ultimately has to approve. I think the timing is actually very good. I think that Congress and the American public need to learn that the other countries of the world are prepared to take serious action if the U.S. takes action. And I think that the statements in recent weeks or days by China and India, but if, you know, especially China, which you know, as the chief economist at the International Energy Agency said last week, China's commitment alone would be responsible, quote, for more than 25% of the reductions the world need to limit planetary warming to 2 degrees Celsius. That is to say, its 2020 target. A billion gigaton off of business as usual, and that's the most important thing to get us off business as usual. So I expect that what will come out of Copenhagen is a framework for a deal and a clear sign that the rest of the world is in fact going to be taking action if the U.S. takes action, and I expect the U.S. will, Congress will agree to take action, and then there will be a global deal.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Neil Moran with National Journal.
Thanks very much for doing this, you guys. I understand that scientists are happy to investigate the quality of the data that they rely on, but this scandal about CRU is about the public's trust in the climate science community. There's a lot of people, judging by Google and others, who frankly have seized on these emails and to dismiss the credibility of your claims. You can see it in Congress, etc. So now, Professor Mann, a minute ago you said you would welcome a scrutiny, but can you say if each of you would rebuild public trust in science by calling for a group of expert outsiders, statisticians or database experts, but not mining engineers, to publicly verify the quality of your database and the CRU's database and software? Because it's not just the emails, it's the reports about the database that are bolstering the confidence of your political opponents.
Gavin, do you want to first, or do you want
to? Can I first state that the CIU are not the only people that hold databases on these things? NASA, the GIST, it's not a project that I'm involved in directly, but it's in the building I work in. NOAA or NCDC maintain their own databases and update them every month from reports from the National Met Services. Those databases are completely public domain. You can go into them and look at anything that you want to look at. The temperature records that you get from GIST Temp or from NCDC or from the Japanese effort, which is also another independent effort, or from the reanalysis projects which come from the ECMWF in Europe or from NCEP in the US or again from the Japanese, all of them show the same information. You know, the issues that CRU has with, you know, the fact that they've been working at this longest and I think have the, you know 30 years of efforts that they've put in and to building their database, you know, they have their own database management issues, obviously, but that isn't the only data that's out there. You can verify that the differences between their estimates of the temperature changes and the estimates that the other groups get is completely minimal, and the impact of the extra data that they have is really maybe it's important in the kind of 19th century. They have more of the older data than the other databases have, but anything that comes to the trends over the 20th century, over the last 30 or 40 years, that's very, very solid and completely verifiable by anybody who wants to verify it. All of this stuff is out there. The GIST temp code is freely available. There's a number of open source projects that have taken it and tried to make it better. Go ahead and knock yourselves out. The answer isn't going to change because there's plenty of existing evidence that's completely independent of the Met stations that demonstrates that the planet has been cooling. That the planet has been warming over the last 40 years. I don't know where that came from. We have ocean temperatures that are completely independent. We have melting glaciers, that's independent. We have changes in phenology, that's the drift of plants, when they bloom in the spring, when birds migrate. There is so much information that tells us that the planet has been warming substantially, that no independent investigation is going to come up with anything other than what we've already concluded. Anybody can look at it, and anybody is welcome to. They're not going to find anything different.
It's important to point out that most of the data has been freely available for decades, and there have been plenty of opportunity for people who wanted to take a look at it and reach a different conclusion to do so, and they haven't. I don't know whether they haven't looked at it or they haven't been able to reach a different conclusion. I suspect the latter.
And I would just add that the people who are saying that they don't trust scientists now are, you know, please comb, you know, LexisNexis. They have made the same precise statements for two decades, and they simply latch on to whatever recent thing they can find and misrepresent it to say the same thing. I think every time an independent body has reviewed the science, including the National Academy back in 2001 when George Bush asked for review, the warming is unequivocal, and the fact that humans are likely to be the principal cause, is very well established science. And I just think, and I would add, just this year, 13 federal agencies published a major report which reviewed the science that Gavin went through and explained what is going to happen on our current emissions path to this country, which is potentially warming of as high as 9 degrees Fahrenheit across much of the country and widespread increases in sea level rise and the Southwest becoming far more arid. So the science, keeps getting clearer and clearer. Those who analyze the science keep coming to the same answer, and those who never believed the science keep coming up with something new to use as an explanation for why they simply don't believe what the science says.
And I'll just add that something new can be often completely inconsistent with what they used just last week. So, you know, the same people that are saying that the climate is cooling, they're relying on the HAD-CRU data set to say that, because that isn't true in the GISTEMP or the NOAA data sets. And they're the same people who are now saying that HAD-CRU can't be trusted. And so, you know, the consistency of the arguments, I think, is one of those tests that you can apply to judge whether somebody is being credible here.
Thank you. Can we go to the next question, please?
Your next question comes from the line of Jeff Tolson with Nature Magazine.
Thanks for holding this, gentlemen. I'm just kind of curious. There have been some accusations that scientists are merely circling the wagons on this issue. I guess I'm more curious in a general manner. Are there lessons that can be learned as far as behavior or policies or procedures or openness that you can draw from this scandal?
I'd like to take a first stab at that, Mike Mann. I think what you have to keep in mind, it's easy for people sort of on the outside within the community to sort of cast stones against those whose emails have been stolen and misrepresented. But you have to recognize that a lot of these emails are 10 years old, and they are sort of a window into an earlier point of evolution of our science when we didn't have the huge database storage facilities to upload very large data sets to a journal's website so anybody who read the paper would have access to the full data. The disclosure requirements at the time by the National Science Foundation, by the journals that publish scientific articles, were very different from what they are today. So I think you should look at what scientists are doing today. And as an example, we published a paper in the journal Science last week where we uploaded, I think, about 30 megabytes of supplementary information to Science's website so that anybody who read the paper had access to every scrap of raw data that we used, every code that we wrote to do our analyses, which, by the way, the National Science Foundation has said is our intellectual property. But we make it available anyways to help move the field forward, to provide our colleagues with the information that they need to help further the science. And so I think what you've seen in recent years, in part in response to the accusations that we have something to hide, which we don't, is that the community has become much more forthcoming in providing as much information as anybody could possibly want. And Gavin has already spoken to that. Anybody who wants to run the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies climate model, one of the models used in the IPCC assessments, can download that model and run it, at least if they have a powerful enough computer. Anybody who wants to rebuild the surface temperature record themselves has access to the raw data that NASA Goddard uses in the GISTEMP record. And one footnote I was going to add to the previous round of discussion is that, in fact, there is a fairly prominent contrarian, Anthony Watts, a weatherman from California, who runs a website that is critical of climate research and climate researchers. And he organized a huge effort to get all the raw data off the public databases and reanalyze the record to show that it was wrong, that it was hopelessly compromised by factors such as the so-called urban heat bias. And it turns out when he and this large group of interested amateurs joined in on this project and produced their own surface temperature record, throwing out all of the data that they claimed was suspect based on the siting of the meteorological stations or other factors, they, guess what? They came up with pretty much the same answer. There was barely any difference at all. And then they got very quiet because that wasn't very interesting to them. They had simply reaffirmed what we already knew.
I want to add to what Michael said that, you know, from my point of view, as a scientist, as an individual, transparency is a good thing. How transparent you have to be is changing over time. We all live, including you guys, live in a different world. And the scientific endeavor is evolving, and our institutions and the individuals involved in them are learning how to be more transparent all the time. IPCC, for instance, has adopted procedures which make much more of the internal mechanism and internal discussions, for instance, the reviewer reports available online so people can read them and make their own judgments about how effective the process is at weeding out things that shouldn't be that are good science versus not so good science. So I think we're all moving into a world which is much more transparent, and that's a great thing. I think the idea of experts making judgments and just telling people what's the case without people having access and being able to take a look at it and other experts make their own judgments, I think that's not the kind of world we want to be in. We do want to be in an open world, and we are getting there.
Thank you. Let's go to our last question, please.
Our final question comes from the line of David Bilo with Scientific American.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having this. I guess my question is about the broader public. What do you make of the polls and other kinds of things that have been released of late, showing declining acceptance of global warming and declining, I guess, public trust in the scientific method in general. And I guess the flip side of that question is, do you think anything good will come out of this release of emails? Thanks.
Well, this is Joe Rome. I'm going to answer that first, and then I would ask each of the three to answer that since this is the last question. I will say the following. I think that the disinformation campaign about climate science and global warming has been ratcheted up, and I think the polling shows that it is more conservatives and conservative-leaning independents who tend to get information from the news groups that repeat the disinformation that have gotten more skeptical. I also think it is the case that if you do an analysis, you find statistically there is less belief in global warming if it's recently been on the coolish side. In October, for those who believe the temperature record, October in the U.S. was the third coolest in the continental U.S. And I will say I think the scientific community has not done a good job of going out and explaining the science, which is one of the reasons that I helped organize this phone call. So I do think that a good outcome of making lemonade out of lemons is that to the extent that you reporters are interested in talking to climate scientists, and this is an opportunity for climate scientists to talk to you and explain the science, and explain why our confidence in it has grown and why our concern about the cost of inaction has grown.
Mike Mann, I can take the next stab here. I think that those polling results unfortunately do demonstrate that it's much easier for cynical individuals and organizations to tear things down than to build them up. Which is to say, there are many of us in the climate research community who consider it very important to discuss in a very frank and open way with the public what the scientific evidence holds, what it shows, because we believe that if the public does come to understand the reality of the science, if we can communicate what the science actually shows, how robust the scientific conclusions behind climate change being a reality and a threat to our future if we don't confront it, if we can explain that to the public, then I believe we will have an informed electorate that can make the right policy choices. We are fighting a headwind in that effort, a stiff headwind. There is, as Joe and others have referred to, a concerted disinformation effort to disinform. So we're trying to educate the public, but against the headwind of others who are trying to confuse them. And frankly, this latest smear campaign, this 11th hour smear campaign, demonstrates the intellectual bankruptcy of those opposed to taking action to combat climate change. They don't have any scientific arguments on their side. They're not even challenging the science. All they've got is innuendo and smear campaigns and twisting the individual words and phrases used by scientists in their private individual correspondences.
Okay, let me kind of finish up, I think, with whether there's anything that's good that's going to come out of these emails. And I think the answer is yes. It might be surprising to my colleagues here. What is going to happen once all the gotcha stuff has worn out and the context has been established? There's not going to be any scientific misconduct associated with this. There's not going to be any fraud. There's not going to be any hoax. But what there will be is a record when you actually look at these emails in detail of how science is actually done. Scientists talking to their colleagues, arguing with their colleagues, being critical of each other's papers, both directly and indirectly, and how the process of, you know, putting together these assessments actually works, and how we actually progress through disagreements that have emerged. And I think that's a very interesting sociology of science that people don't often see, because what they see are the scientific papers and the press releases associated with them and the cover art on Nature. And to some extent, you know, that's an artifice. Our scientific papers, as Peter Medawar very eloquently said in an essay that he, I think, in 1964, the narrative that we put into scientific papers is not a fair description of how we came up with the answers in the first place. And coming up with the science, progressing the science, is much messier than the classic mythology of how science works that a lot of people have. And so I think in time, this and other ways that people are going to see more openness and transparency in the science, they'll see that, you know, scientists are human. They'll see how science progresses despite our human failings, and why science as an enterprise works despite the fact that scientists aren't perfect.
And I would add to that that I think the public may come to appreciate that science is not monolithic, but you have people approaching these problems with different views and different approaches, and that despite those differences, they are able to agree and reach a consensus on a very substantial body of what we do know, and that despite all the fighting and the healthy disagreements, there is enough that we do know for policymakers to be able to move forward on the problem. I think that the more that scientists are able to draw on the lessons of this episode and be able to be willing to be more transparent about how we do the business, as Gavin said, and about what the differences are, and about how we nevertheless can reach agreement on the critical elements of a problem like this, I think that the public and the public debate and all of us are better off.
Thank you. At this time, I'd like to end the call and let you all know that we will have transcript and audio available later this afternoon. Again, my contact information is 202-481-8224, and my email address is semmerling@americanprogress.org. I'd like to thank Professor Mann, Dr. Schmidt, Dr. Oppenheimer, and Dr. Rome for participating in our call today. Thank you.